Good afternoon, Montreal. You're now listening to Movement Museum here on CKUT 90.3. It is now 2:04. My name is Jen Doan, and I'm in the studio today with Allison Burns and a special guest, Laura Kramer. And so for today, we're going to talk to Laura a little bit. She is a choreographer and a dancer here based in Montreal. And she's got a show opening this weekend, actually, at the May, at the Montreal Arts Intercultural Center, I guess that's what it's called. And the show is opening tonight. Her show is called Of Good Moral Character. And I just want to welcome Laura onto the show and just get straight into it. And I want to hear more about your work that's going to be premiering tonight. How are you today, Laura?
I'm doing good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I was checking out Laura's website just earlier, and it's really quite amazing and inspiring to see. Laura actually studied at Concordia. I think Laura was a year older than me and Allison at the Concordia Contemporary Dance Choreography Program. And since graduating in 2008, Laura, that's when you graduated?
Yeah.
You've been doing a lot of things. You've been traveling, getting residencies, and creating work and touring. And it's really inspiring to see that, you know, you've continued on with the path after school and continued to, you know, create and perform, which is, you know, really inspiring to just see someone who's continuing to go and will just continue to go further. And I can tell that you're a very dedicated and passionate woman. So can you talk a little bit about your new show Of Good Moral Character?
Sure. So Of Good Moral Character is a creation that sort of first came to mind shortly after I created my first full-length work, Fragments. So it's been a while in the making, and not all just in studio, but just in terms of my personal process and investigation. It's a duet with Lael Stelic, who's also a Concordia graduate, and myself. So it's male-female duet. And it's looking at the intimacy of relationships within the domestic setting or the conventional home, and I guess touching upon very specific themes of obsession, isolation, the cycles of abuse. And yeah, that's sort of a summary of the piece.
Sounds like it would be a very dynamic and explosive kind of show. Just the balances of the themes you're talking about, you know, especially with the violence and the abuse and isolation and all those things. They're heavy topics.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me, like, you know, what were the seeds that inspired this work? Where did this come from?
Wow. Well, it actually, you know, it's interesting talking about actually the content of the work now, because the initial seeds of it I found were much more, introspective and very soft. The The piece initially, I became interested in working with this relationship of woman to water. So there's a main central decor in my piece, which is the bathtub. Mm. And this came to me from one of my elders passed on this native teaching to me, which is that women are the protectors of water. And it stuck with me for quite a while, and I was sort of inquisitive to, as well, you know, looking at the state of our natural waters today, and then looking also at the conditions in which we live and how we relate to water, and sort of questioning that, you know, my sort of firstly contact to it is for pure necessity within the home. And so it was really that first inspiration that made me just question myself in terms of my own personal relationships within the home, and then this disconnect from water as a sacred source, and curious to how that affects, you know, my daily livelihood, my interpersonal relationships, my connection or disconnection from what I consider the sacred. So from that teaching, the idea of working with a bathtub was first sort of developed, and I started working literally in my bathtub at home. And not necessarily, I didn't really want to create a narration of, oh, woman and water. Like, it was really like the thing that fed me, you know, and just being really connected to that. Like, I didn't set out with one specific narration in mind. I really wanted the work to sort of unfold for itself, and yeah.
They're very compelling images as well, with you in the bathtub. They're really beautiful. Mm. And I just wanted to touch again on what you were saying about the sacredness of water and our relationship to it. Mm-hmm. Now, especially, you know, now in this day where there's just so much, there's so much chaos environmentally.
Yeah.
And water, the way that it's being treated in our relationship to it, it's just so fundamental. Yet somehow I feel that a lot of us, we're very disconnected.
Yeah.
To our water source, to our life source. And what's really interesting, I was thinking about how I was told the other day that the markets are crashing. And so instead, people are now starting to buy gold to kind of save and keep, you know, like something valuable that they would be able to trade in when the world crashes. And it struck me as kind of funny, like, okay, I can understand why, you know, gold is something that is not like a paper form of, you know, exchange. And then I was thinking, I'm like, you know what, it's actually the things like our air and our water, those are sacred. Those are what we need to be thinking about and preserving, you know. When everything might crash, that's what we really need, is like those basic fundamental things that nurture ourselves and our beings, is the water and the air. And so I was just thinking about how important that is when you were saying that your elders were teaching you about how women were protectors of our water.
Yeah, well, it's and you know, and like you're saying, just the current state of our environment, it's, I mean, for me, the way in which we relate to it very much parallels, I feel, the way in which we relate to our intimate partners, to our, you know, our human relations, you know, this attitude of, you know, whether it's like a means of sort of having aggression or control or ownership or possession, like it's, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I feel like those ideas are very much sort of influenced with, you know, what's happening globally versus, you know, also within the privacy of the home.
And so what made you decide on creating a duet for this piece specifically with Lael, as you were like exploring on your own?
Specifically as Lael as an interpreter, just knowing I needed a male dancer.
I guess you needed a male dancer because it was a lot about domestic relationships.
Yeah, and I mean, I didn't necessarily set out to, you know, tell one specific story of two, you know, intimate partners. Like, I mean, Lael for me symbolizes a multitude of different men for me in the work. But Lael specifically, it's funny, like, I actually, I had a couple dreams about him. And actually, like, I had a couple dreams, vivid dreams with him and my set design. Like, I had envisioned, like, you know, exactly the tub and just how it was, like, lit in this really isolated light. And his presence, his you know, spirit was there. And also Lael, in terms of, like, just his natural... you know, character is, I knew someone I could work with. Like, he has, his capacity for great sensitivity and vulnerability. And this is, I mean, that's what excites me when I go and see shows, when someone can, like, really kind of strip the layers down and totally expose themselves. And, this is where I wanted to go with, my work and then working with someone.
I had a question in my mind as you were talking about the bathtub. How did you find the bathtub, and, like, how was it transporting the bathtub to the theater? What was that like? Was that a complicated process?
It's always complicated. I mean, finding it, I was actually lucky. I have a great set designer, Robert, and he helped create my previous set design for Fragments. And so when he knew I wanted a bathtub, and you know, I was very specific that I wanted you know, the old school one with the feet, the porcelain
types,
he kept his eyes open, and sure enough, he found two old bathtubs in this guy's backyard. Like, they were totally, like, in the garden and muddy, and the larger one, him and his friend couldn't lift. Like, it was just extremely heavy. Like, you needed at least, like, three guys to lift it. And so the bathtub that he ended up taking was a smaller version. It's not, I think there's, the standard length is, like, 6 feet, and mine's, like, I think it's, like, 5 feet. So it's a little smaller. And so getting it to my house was, you know, no problem, because I had... my set designer, Rob, who has a pickup truck. And actually, he did end up helping me transport it to the theater. But I have had sort of times where I've... when I had my residency at USINSE, I had a friend with a hatchback car, like, help me transport it. So
people with cars are so useful for performers. When it comes to production time, it's just like, who's got a car?
Who's gonna be my friend this week?
Yeah. Who wants to lift this heavy thing? It's like, wow.
Yeah. So can you talk more about the residencies? Did you get two residencies for this show that you created? You were mentioning one for USINSE and the one at Cirque Ouest. Is that for the same piece this week?
Yeah, for the same piece, and as well as one with the May, the theater. Yeah.
So sorry for interrupting. How long was this process from kind of the beginning, wherever you would mark that, until this premiere of it? How long is it been in creation?
Well, in terms of actually beginning in a studio, it would be about a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, I worked on and off quite a bit. I stretched it out for a few reasons. It had been a while since I had been performing in my own work in terms of from the beginning of a creation. So I wanted some space to really have time to reflect. And then, as well as the way in which the residencies were lined up, and in terms of also the premieres, why, you know, it was a bit more stretched. And I just was in a place a year ago to really dive into the studio. So I began with Lael last November. Mm-hmm. And we worked, I think, maybe 5 weeks, and took a few months off, and then returned back in March. And at that point, I had my mentor with Sequies and Catherine Tardif at that time. And that was a really, really fulfilling process for me, was having, you know, an established choreographer. Well, Catherine, specifically mm-hmm. Catherine Tardif, come in and give me some just, like, pure feedback. I didn't give her much of a rundown. I didn't give her any rundown, actually, of what it was I was trying to do, or any content or reference to the piece. I just said, okay, I've got 12 or 14 sections I want to show you, and I want to see what your reaction is. I wanted to just understand if what it was I was trying to convey was being relayed mm-hmm. from the outside. And I found it a very useful method and approach to work with her. And then after that period, so I worked a couple months in the spring, and then I went into like a week-long residency at USINSEE in June, and that was quite brilliant because it was an opportunity to, because prior to that point, I'd been working with the bathtub in my house, and then, you know, doing a lot of like solo research in my home, and then in the studio with Lael. So having that residency was the time to really, you know, combine, you know, the pieces of the works that I had and see it in its full and have the lights come in and be designed and developed and, you know, illuminate the tone of the work. So yeah, that was extremely, extremely helpful in the sort of, developing the narration, the fullness of the work.
And for the music, was that created for you? Which we'll play for the listeners a little bit of a little sample of the music.
Mm-hmm. It's actually
after the break
right now.
Oh, it's okay. behind the our conversation.
Are you playing the first track? So yeah. This is Chris Dirksen, and this is not an original score for my work, but I did get permission to use it. She's a lovely, talented woman.
Where is she from?
Vancouver.
Okay. So your show is going to be playing at the Mai this weekend. I just want to give everybody a rundown again of the time. I believe it's playing at 8 o'clock, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's 8
and
o'clock.
3 p.m. on Sunday.
And 3 p.m. on Sunday.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had another question. It just slipped my mind. Oh, I wanted to talk actually a little bit about your background and your work, because you have an Ojibwe and Cree background, and a lot of your work, it seems, is inspired by your Aboriginal roots. And mm-hmm. And you were saying also in your biography that through your creative process and through the work that you've been creating, it's allowed you to connect a lot to your roots. And I know Fragments was a big piece for you that you've toured and you've worked on for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little more about that, like just how you've, you know, been using and taking your roots and finding your roots too through your work?
Yeah, well, it's Fragments was definitely sort of the pivotal point in connecting to that. So it's a piece that was inspired by my mother's stories that she, you know, had from, and her experiences from living in the Indian residential schools of Canada. And like growing up, this was a very well-known and, I habitually heard stories over and over from my mother, and, you know, understanding that there was this history in, for the First Nations people of Canada, just it was known to me at such a young age. I think I remember as young as 4 is understanding, you know, as a 4-year-old could understand sort of what that meant, you know. It meant that she wasn't allowed to speak her language, her culture was taken away from her or you know, stripped of her. And, you know, I didn't grow up with I had some connections to my culture growing up for sure. Like my mother was definitely, you know, had some links and ties to her history. But growing up in that sort of, having a parent who was a product of assimilation definitely created this fragmentation of your culture, your identity, of her identity, mm-hmm. and then seeing that became, I think, I'll just say, like, I didn't grow up with a sense of pride of my culture at all, you know. When I think, I can't speak for all, but for any survivor who experiences the Indian residential school, I think there's a lot of you know, confliction of honoring their, you know, that they come out with this sort of, I imagine, a confliction of, feeling pride for their culture, for their identity. You know, the whole point of them was to, you know, turn them into good little Christians. And so for me, it was something that had been, I guess, developing in me for a while, like further looking into that history. And a lot had to do, I think, with just kind of, you know, in a sense, sorting out my own sort of issues and understanding, like, how the rippling effect of, you know, the intergenerational effect of assimilation, how it plays out into just my own sort of, you know, state, well-being. But also it was developed from a lot of just personal rage that our Canadian government hasn't really honored that history and offered a respect for it. And coincidentally, when my work, when I was going through this, the, you know, Harper government was actually at that point offering this apology to survivors of the residential school. And it's kind of interesting how that paralleled my process. And, you know, I had such mixed feelings during that, and it definitely fueled me more to just be like, wow, this work really needs to be seen. And it's like, any time you hear, you know, the subject matter of the Indian residential school, it's so political and heated. And I think a general public, I mean, I imagine it doesn't keep room for people to want to understand that history, you know, like not many people want to talk about dead Indian children and really go there, you know, mm-hmm. especially if it's not your culture and like relating to it. Just, I mean, it's so horrific what happened.
Yeah, it's a difficult topic to address whether you are within the culture and the heritage or not. It's a very difficult topic to address.
Yeah.
And I was also, you know, I was thinking, as you were speaking about the experiences of, you know, your ancestors and your mom, the conflicts or the trauma that our ancestors go through resonate throughout, you know, the generations a lot. And like, and they will continue to, you mm-hmm. know, children of war. It's just like, you feel like it starts to like phase off, but it really affects the generations that go on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And it's really something that it sticks. It's something that's very powerful. And I think that, the process of bringing light to it or speaking about it or working with it somehow may help the process of dissolution. I think anyways, that's very important because I know that my family left after the Vietnam War, and for a very long time, I have a lot of aggression and I through a lot of, you know, searching and work to understand that, I just realized, like, wow, like my parents lived through war, and that type of aggression, it carries on, you know, and it really holds on and it carries on. And sometimes when you, like, being born in Calgary, Alberta, and being so far away from that reality of war, but still it affects me a lot. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that, you know, the children of the people, whether it was war or the residential schools, you still carry that. And I think through the artistic process of maybe just examining that will help somehow bring light to it and dissolve it and bring up questions, but also maybe even answers.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, I initially created the work, like a big motive was to create it for an audience who didn't know much or not at all the history of the residential school, because I felt sort of, you know, just kind of fed up that you know, this is something I've lived with since I was so little, yet most Canadians don't know their own Canadian history. It's astonishing. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I felt that through, you know, a poetic work, you know, I was hoping that would become more inviting for people to gain a curiosity of that history. But it is interesting that I've also had the opportunity to present that work to survivors and children of survivors, and it's that's where I feel like, you know, that sort of connection or path in terms of connecting further with my roots has really opened. And it's floored me at times when I've met other survivors and also children of survivors, and we share similar stories or you know, experiences in terms of how we were parented, and mm-hmm. and it, there's sort of this like
patterns of behaviors or patterns of kind of
patterns
the way of approaching relationships and the world,
patterns of behaviors and patterns of sort of I don't know if I want to say them all, but it's like I feel like it somehow allowed me to make sense of my personal situation, be like, oh, okay, I'm not alone in, you know, having a parent who just couldn't parent me, you know, just really didn't have this ability, you know, it comes from, you know, there's a reason, you know, and I looked at, you know, by investigating it kind of all makes sense, and it's not something that's just, you know, distinct to, you know, one person but that it's an actual rippling of, like, you understand the effects of genocide, and that's what happened. And my last 2 cents about the Harper government is they still have yet to call it that, you know? They don't acknowledge it as a genocide, but, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to also ask you, with the work Fragments, because, mm-hmm. again, I'm bringing it up because I know it was, like, a really big piece for you, and you had toured it and stuff. Where were you able to present it? I know that you went and toured to Banff. You got a Banff residency, right?
I was at Banff this summer teaching for called the Indigenous Dance Summer Residency Program. This was a very intimate program. They had 12 invited artists, and I was there to create a work on the emerging dancers. And then the piece Fragments was invited to be remounted there and performed for 2 evenings at the end of this summer program. And that was intense. Like, I actually, living that was, I had a moment where I was like, I don't know if I can do this piece again, because it's so heavy, and especially when you're showing it to an audience who, like, you've built personal relationships with, and they all, you know, and they all are connected to that history in some way, whether it's their parents or grandparents who went to the residential schools, and it can get so emotionally charged. But, you know, I'm always getting feedback that, you know, this is a work that needs to be seen, and it's, you know, of a, you know, it has a history and informative aspect to it that I think is very useful in terms of, I think, opening people up to that history.
And how have the response has been throughout different places that you have brought the work to?
I've had some people just, like, completely break down and cry and come up to me and just, like, thank me. And I've had some people just be, you can see they're a bit stunned. They're like, I can't believe I'm learning this through a dance piece. You know, like they're just amazed that they never knew about it. And no, I've had people become very emotional, and I mean, there's been a range. Like, I've had a lot, I'd say. I mean, it's always hard to really judge, like, people's reactions, because yeah. I mean, I have had someone be, you know, be very, like, kind of aggressive and angry, but that was from, like, simultaneously they were, like, encouraging the work, but it was just, like, you know, they were really distraught from having things triggered. And but I've definitely had a lot of encouragement for this work. And
how many dancers were in the work?
Four dancers.
Yeah. And have you had different dancers throughout the different?
I have.
So my question I was wondering is, how do you
select the dancers?
How do you select the dancers? How do you bring them into a process that is so personal to you? You know, like, someone who's just coming in might not even, you know, have much of an understanding, say, of the history and the experience itself.
Yeah.
How did you integrate them into that? Because I feel like it's very, like, it's very personal. So how do you?
Yeah, it was a length. Like, initially, the original cast, I had 4 dancers. I wasn't performing in it, and I had conducted interviews because I wanted, I wanted a certain sort of character of person who I knew would be willing to go somewhere that wasn't necessarily going to be, you know, light. It was like, you know, I'm a lot of the process, there was a lot of storytelling involved, and then also meeting survivors and hearing their stories. And so there was, for me, a point where I was like, okay, I need, you know, I don't think every interprete would necessarily choose to go into a work like this. So it was looking for, I think a lot of it was based on just my intuition, if I knew this person would be sensitive and mm-hmm. and, you know, was genuine in terms of wanting, had natural curiosity to learn about this history. So yeah, to reiterate, there was a period of where I was doing a lot of storytelling. And then at one point during the process, I actually took a trip to my mother's residential schools in Manitoba. And I did this alone. I would have loved to have brought the dancers, but I didn't have a budget for it. And that was a really shifting point for me in the process. I visited once one of the schools she went to when I was 9. And this time I went, I was offered a residency for a week. And it's called Portage la Prairie. And it's the Indian Residential School Museum of Canada. And I spent a week there with my mother, and, you know, different survivors came and I met, and I was doing ceremony every day with my mother. And the work that I showed at the end was just like a self-solo exploration. And it was done in a very traditional way with prayer and ceremony. And when I returned, I was like, okay, this is an aspect of the process that I need to invite the dancers mm-hmm. in. Like, for now, it's been, you know, me telling stories and giving them text, and I showed, you know, documentary. But I wanted them to experience the beauty of the culture, the sacredness, the ceremonies. And so I found a couple elders to work with and invited them into the studio. And That was intense, and I think, I mean, there's so much it was so intimate, you know, and what takes place in those spaces is very, private and intimate, and for me it was transforming to witness each of my dancers, like, I don't know if the words for it, but yeah, to break down in a way, to really touch and go like, oh yeah, like, it's like they took a breath and it was like, this is real. Like, it's not, we're not just, and I always said, like, this isn't a performance. Like, we're trying to touch the spirit and the roots of this history. And, you know, we need to honor that. And it was, for me, that was so beautiful because, you know, working with non-native dancers for me gave me this opportunity to pass on the history in a way that they're not just learning about it through, you know, media or through, you know, stories in passing, but they're experiencing it firsthand in a way of meeting a survivor one-on-one and sharing an experience and it's real. It's not this thing of the past. It's like it's present day reality. Like, there are survivors.
The experiences I feel are carried in the survivors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Will there be a second life for Fragments?
Well, it's kind of been continuous. Do you mean second life in what,
like,
sense?
Just in terms of bringing it back and going, you know, to perform it again and bringing it on stage again.
Yeah, there's talk of it. It's not confirmed yet, but it has been invited to Toronto this summer. And that's exciting because I have not yet performed in mm-hmm. Toronto, and it would be for an Aboriginal festival at Harbourfront. I don't have all, like, it's don't have all the details yet of this, but it's nice to know that that it's kind of interesting, like, that I think part of the reason why has this continuous life is that history doesn't become obsolete, you mm-hmm, know, it's mm-hmm. become, it's still very pertinent. And yeah.
And just going back to of good moral character, mm-hmm. does the work carry the traces of what you've gone through and experienced with Fragments in terms of understanding more of your roots and your culture and even the spiritual aspect? Because I feel as though there must be like a deep spiritual, just being in touch with that aspect in your creative process.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in terms of spiritual connection of the work, it's like, I don't know, I think a lot is just, it's so, how would I say, it's kind of embedded in just in the way in which I feel like my process it goes or unfolds, and how there's always these connection, deeper connections I find when I'm inside the work and I'm, you know, experiencing something with Lael, but it's like it feels sometimes connected to, like, you know, maybe an ancestor or part of, like, you know, like I said, he doesn't represent just one figure male in my life, but a multitude of them. What was the previous question? I'm sorry, I just had
it was a complicated...
The connection kind of came to the work in terms of my...
Oh, the traces of, you know, of... the traces of this Fragments being such a significant body of work and mm-hmm. like something that you've really gone in through, and like how maybe those traces continue to move into your work, which yeah. is this piece.
I mean, I do think there are traces, and I it's funny because I didn't set out to do that, but it you become, you know, when you do create this, I mean, for me, creating this full first length work, it becomes part of, I guess, a bit of your identity. And I definitely worked with themes of isolation and Fragments, and it was something that, a theme that is not something I'm done with. Mm-hmm. And also the violence is another thing that came out that I do see it as a trace from that previous work, but it's, you know, done through a different lens and mm-hmm. in a different context and... in a sort of more complicated and twisted way, the abuse has sort of been developed in this work. Mm. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I want to thank you, Laura, so much for coming onto the show and sharing with us
thank
your
you.
Process and your history. And for those who are listening, please check out her work, Laura's work, Laura Kramer. She's presenting... Of Good Moral Character. The show opens tonight at the May, and it will be running Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday at 3:00,
mm-hmm.
I believe. Yeah. So if you want more information, you can also check out her website at larakramer.ca, LaraKramer.ca. Check out her website and everything that she is doing. She's definitely up and coming and a very dedicated, passionate woman, and you're definitely going to see a lot more of her. So thank you so much, Laura, for coming on.
Thank you.
You're
pleasure.
Welcome. We're going to take a short break and we'll come back with a little bit more of Movement Museum. You've been listening to Movement Museum here in CKUT 90.3. It's 2:41, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
1, 2, 3.
Esto es únicamente una prueba. 1, 2, 1, 2.
In Montreal.
CKUT. All the rhythms, all the music, all the time.
90.3 FM.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. You are now listening to Movement Museum here on CKUT 90.3. That was a score by composer Chris Dirksen, and that score is part of Laura Kramer's work. We've been speaking with her in the first part of the show about her premiere of Good Moral Character playing at the Mai. And just before we go back to finish our interview with Laura, I just wanted to have a quick dance history for today. So for today, we have Gwen Verdon, I believe. Gwyneth Evelyn Verdon was born in January 13th, 1925, and died October 18th, 2000, at age 75. She was a child of English immigrants to the United States. They were show people, her mother a dancer and her father an electrician for MGM Studios. As a child, Verdon had rickets, a disease which caused her legs to misdevelop, putting her in orthopedic braces as a toddler. Her mother enrolled her in ballet class, which helped strengthen her legs, and by the age of six, she was dancing on stage. In her early adult career, she assisted choreographer Jack Cole, but that came to little success, and she returned to LA to teach dance. Her first New York break came in 1953 when she was cast in Can Can, a role which brought her a Tony and a pay raise. That's what we all need. Her next role was perhaps her most famous, that of Lola, the devil's assistant in the musical Damn Yankees. The musical was choreographed by Bob Fosse. This was the start of a lifelong, fruitful collaboration between Fosse and Verdon. Gwen starred in Fosse's work Street Charity and Chicago and assisted him on the film production of Cabaret in Berlin. They wed in 1960. Verdon and Fosse separated but never divorced and had one daughter together. They continued to work closely together until his death, after which she became one of the guardians of his work. She and her daughter were integral to the staging of the musical revue Fosse. She died in the home of her daughter in October 18th of 2000. The lights were dimmed on Broadway at 8 p.m. that night in her honor. So just before we come back to Laura, I just wanted to say thank you to everybody who's listening and to everybody who contributed to CKUT's funding drive, which ended on the 30th of October. I believe it was successful. Yes, it was very successful. So thank you, everybody who called and contributed generously to help CKUT run. And otherwise, without you guys, we would not be here and we would not get a chance to have one of the only dance talk radio shows in North America, I believe. But there's another one, Evie Dance in Toronto. We'll give them shout outs. Anyway, so we're going to come back to Laura, and just to finish up, so Laura, can you just talk a little bit about the residency you had with the Mai?
Yeah, so the residency with the Mai offered sort of like an accompaniment, kind of like a mentorship, in which they gave a lot of freedom and choice in terms of sort of being able to, I guess, state sort of what it was I felt at this phase or point in my, career or path, what kind of support I would need. So it was very, very specific. And, I did definitely have time in the theater and a lot of amount of hours in the studio. But this added support, I definitely benefited greatly from it. And so I was able to basically further develop my relation and support from my communication agent, Kesha, through the Mai's residency and accompaniment program, which is definitely very, very useful in terms of when, I'm starting out to tour more and have this aspect of my work become more accessible outside of Montreal.
And so I know I've had a few friends who've had a residency there, and they're very supportive. And in terms of the
Extremely.
Resources they provide you,
mm-hmm.
I know Carmen had Carmen Ruiz had a residency there, and from what I know too, they help you create and build a website so that you can really get your marketing aspect on the ball.
Yeah, that I actually already had in development. So I didn't actually use that accompaniment for that. But definitely in terms of, you know, this I think more sort of the business aspect or the more administrative aspect of my work, I definitely got great support in being able to, you know, carry on with this relation with an agent and have this become further developed in my work.
Mm-hmm. And the work is going on tour already. You have another gig somewhere at some point?
Yeah, it's been booked at Peterborough New Dance in February. So it's going to be there on, I believe it's Friday the 17th. So it's one evening. Mm-hmm. And it has also been invited back, or my work has been invited to the Talking Sticks Festival. I performed there last year with Fragments. So it's
what is the Talking Sticks Festival?
It's an Aboriginal arts festival based in Vancouver. Mm. And actually that's where I met and first heard Chris Dirksen.
Are you originally from Vancouver?
No.
Where are you originally
I'm originally from?
From
London, Ontario.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just as we wrap up the show, are there any last words on the show that you want people to know about, or maybe even points of reflection for yourself about this whole process and the work itself?
I mean, I'm just super excited to be at the point of showing the work, and I'm just curious to how people will receive it, and extremely grateful for all the support I've had through this process. So I'd like to thank Circuits, Catherine Tardif, Yuzin Se, The May, their whole team, mm-hmm. my whole team of artists and technicians. Mm-hmm. It's been a really rich and positive experience. So
that's one of the things I find with dance and the creation of is that it really takes a large community and resource.
Yeah.
You know, like your show is two performers, you're the choreographer, but in terms of the resources and the support that's required, the studio space, the production aspect, the rehearsal assistant, the set designers, the lighting designers, and all of those people who bring to come together mm-hmm. for a show, it's really amazing. And I think that it's also a very rich, you know, experience to have as an artist, as a performing artist, because it really does take a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess, yeah, that's about it. We're going to we'll just say thank you again, and we're going to just
thank
tell everybody,
for having me.
Telling everybody to come see the show at the May or the Mai. I say the May, they say the Mai. It's tonight and Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday at mm-hmm. 3:00. So please check that out and check out LaraKramer.ca, LaraKramer.ca. Thank you, Lara.
Merci.
Good luck. Yes. And that's about it. We're just going to play a little more from this track, and please come back next week on Movement Museum from Thursday 2 to 3 and keep yourself nice and dry if you can. So have a good afternoon and have a good weekend, everyone.